But yeah, as we saw last time we did this, we had a very dramatic confrontation between Shabtai Tzvi and Nechemia HaKohen, the supposed Polish / Ashkenazi couple, in which Shabtai Tzvi is challenged to prove his approach, saying that he's a Mashiach. They have a very long 3-day debate.
Nechemia was in the claim that he's the Mashiach and Mashiach.
Right, that's right. And everyone agrees that the grand finale in the problem is that, as we know, Shabtai Tzvi said that Mashiach ben Yosef is a Talmud of Israel with Rav Zalman, no one ever heard of. And Nechemia Cohen doesn't take that. He says, when you're talking about I was supposed to be Mashiach ben Yosef. Okay. Tradition says that blames / attributes Shabtai Tzvi's fall to the Chemical.
Like the 17s, you blame this on him?
No, the non-17s. 17s have been up, non-17s.
The 17s obviously never have fall.
Just the basic fact that someone challenged him.
Yeah, in other words, they claim that he went to the Turks, accused Shabtai Tzvi of rebellion. The Turks said, I mean, no, maybe he's right, and they went and came to inspect. Now, as we saw last time, that's most likely not true. The Turks had a slowly but surely paid more attention to what was going on. They had translated a lot of Shabtai Tzvi's declarations, he abolished Tisha B'Av because of Shiv's here, etc., etc.
So,
what?
Personally.
Well, they didn't care about him abolishing Tisha B'Av, but they weren't concerned if their, Jews rebelled against them. That was not their concern, especially as, one thing Turkey and Poland had in common in that era was all trade was in Jewish hands. That's what I mean. So it was probably the Turks had been paying attention to him, as we have seen. They also knew about a number of his innovations. He made what we had seen, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago, holiday of lights, changing Shabbos, all sorts of interesting things. Give great shots. Whatever. Yeah, I
think he's there or is
he adding whatever. These type of things. You're right, it's because you're jumping in at the end. I mean, this is not, it's just crazy, right?
This is you married a fish. No. You married the Sefer Torah and had a fish baby.
Yeah, no, I
want to
do
it. Okay, so. It wasn't for Shabtai Tzvi. This is not, it's strange, but Shabtai Tzvi, what do you expect, but okay, whatever. Matyar Asur, I'm not sure if they picked up on that, but okay, yeah, he did those type of things. Okay, September 12th or 13th, 1666, Turkish soldiers come and arrest Shabtai Tzvi. They take him. He was in Gallipoli, which I showed you guys, remember, take first to Adrianople and then on to Constantinople. Nople just means city, in case you're not aware of that. He gets to Constantinople by the 16th. The great final announcement. This is not the final, this is like, I'm not sure it's the most dramatic part of the whole story, but it's definitely a very important part. Shabtai Tzvi's apostasy, turning Muslim, is, of course, a very critical part of the whole Shabtai Tzvi story. Now, we have, like much else here, 2.5 sources about it. 2.5, 3, depending on how you want to count. We have 9 17 sources, Jewish and non-Jewish. We have 17 sources. That we have very small amount of Turkish sources, which is a real shame that the Turks didn't write down what happened, because they were, you know, key to the most unbiased observers, were closest to it. They would have definitely, you know, fixed the picture in full vision. So we were slightly crippled in terms of absolute understanding of what happened, because we misinterpreted. Turkish sources are rare, but very little. There are enough there to believe that the Turks planned it relatively well, and were relatively sure. I mean, there's no way to be sure, of course, that they were that they planned in advance offering him the option of converting to Islam.
Okay, they bring him in. They bring him in, and he's accused of rebellion.
He's accused of rebelling against the Sultan and Dato Achas Rahamis. Earlier Sultans had killed their brothers because of Shash, because it may lead to murder the Mahmus. So, you know, certainly someone who's claiming to be king and he's going to walk in and say to him, and the Sultan is going to hand him his turban and his scepter. That's definitely. Rebellion. I mean, that's like a strange type of rebellion, but that is definitely maybe considered rebellion.
Now, the Jewish sources say, the Jewish anti-Sabbatean sources say that when he was accused of claiming to be Mashiach and rebelling, he said, I never said anything. Other people said I was Mashiach, I just didn't argue with them. That's what Jewish sources say. Now, he was told he has a choice. He can perform a miracle or convert. What's the miracle he has to perform?
This is from Jewish sources.
This is from non-Jewish sources. The archers are going to shoot at him. And if he doesn't get hurt, then it proves that he's a machine. So, Shabtai Tzvi says, okay, I will accept to become the proper one. He either has to do that, either let them shoot at him. And one of them says, maybe they can try to behead him, okay, whatever. They can try to, he has to perform something serious, be killed, which probably involves being killed, or accept Islam. So he says, fine, I'll accept Islam. And he accepts, he becomes a Muslim. He is given the name.
The new name,
Aziz Mehmed Efendi.
Sounds like it means something.
Yeah, it probably does mean something. But it's not that important. You know, he's not historically known by Aziz Mehmed Efendi. He's historically known as Shafi'i Tzvi. Okay.
Seems a lot
so, I guess
he was a lot anti
sort of, just right. Sam, just right. Okay, so the Jewish anti-Sabbatean and the non-Jewish versions all have him, after conversion, denouncing Judaism, etc., etc., blasphemy, whatever, you know, becoming a true renegade, whatever. It's slightly different version, but that's not so important, all the details there. But all these versions have that. There's reason to believe that those are kingdom additions. In other words, as we're going to see, Shabtai Tzvi, even after he converts, still maintains his Mashiach. Yeah, I guess that's more clear. How's that for more drama? And as a result of that, in Akilu, he's like making a combined religion of sorts. So, to say that he completely rejected Judaism after he was in front of the Sultan, you can't say it's impossible, of course, but it doesn't really fit so well with the continuum that happens in the longer run to Shabtai Tzvi. Sabbatean sources, for some reason, and it's really funny,
we'll see, we start seeing, I think this week, and see more of it next week. If the 17 sources have Shabtai Tzvi being extremely passive, but the most is saying yes when he's offered to convert. Because the other sources say, yes, I convert. And he has shot the target. They say to him, they say, you've been accused of being Mashiach. And he says, I was not. I never said it. Other people said it. I mean, there are sources we saw a couple of weeks ago that when he was in his ear, he was accused of it. He was brought to the Qadi, the Turkish judge, and said, people say you're Mashiach. He said, I never said anything. Other people said it. So he has said that before. In other words, that statement has believability in it because we know he's done something like that before. And it's like he would have character. The 17 sources have him being completely silent and accepting the turban, as they call it, accepting Islam in a very passive and almost in a very passive fashion with the minimal amount of action on his part. That's what the 17 sources have it as. And in light of later 17 doctrine, which we'll get into a little this week and more next week, it's a little funny. In other words, it's a little funny that they apologetic about it. Okay. Okay, now, the facts are like this. Shabtai Tzvi has already been Michal Shabbos and claimed that he had deep mystical reasons for it. He has, offered his slaughter, his kibbutz offered a korban Pesach, cooked it in its own chaluf, eaten it, claiming to be Mizbeach, based on mystical reasons. So, even though it's sort of still, you call it anticlimactic, I mean, it's somewhat surprising that when he's given the choice to convert
its own Caleb.
Its own Caleb.
Isn't it supposed to be I'm guessing, not about that, is it?
He said not to, yeah, that's one of the most bizarre, I think that's one of the most bizarre Shabbat Tzvi episodes.
How do you get its own Caleb?
Chelov is the Nevi in Wazir.
Oh, Chelov.
It's fat. It's forbidden fats. So, that he keeps thought he was doing the mitzvah and then a mega all at once. Like, he's not just serving, doing it, like, whatever. I don't know. But anyway, he's done strange things already, He's done very strange things, Shabtai. So, converting is very strange, but Lamaisa, he's from Kal Shabbos already. Yeah, so it's not absolutely out of character for Shabtai Tzvi now to convert the claim, the mystical secrets, and that's why he has to convert. Now, of course, for those of us that don't know about Shabtai Tzvi, what's the question we have to ask here?
Is he Manny?
There you go, so the man knows it. He's been educated in this way. Is Shabtai Tzvi manic, normal, or depressed at this point? That's the question. And as far as we can tell, he's not there. As far as we can tell, he's basically normal at this point. And as a result, that definitely means that at this point, he's like, I wouldn't call it, totally out of character yet. It's not like the general predictable Shabtai Tzvi wild acts all happened when he's manic, and he wasn't really manic over here, so it's most likely he was not manic. Yeah, there is some evidence that right after this episode, Shabtai Tzvi went depressive. Which I guess is pretty, understandable. Okay. Now, and one of the things we've seen in the entire story is we're used to those traveling literally at the speed of light. And today things happen. And if you're not the president of the United States of America, and you have, and you're famous, and you have a Twitter account, right? You Twitter out what you're doing. And instantaneously, you want 5 million people to have it? Something like that. So, we're used to speed traveling, sets, and we're used to traveling really not normally quickly. However, back in the old days, it took a long time for news to travel. It took a long, long time for news to travel. People who spread this news were the Turks, of course. The Turks declared that Shabtai Tzvi is converted, and the total across the board reaction to the news in the Jewish world was absolute shock. That was not, you know, you call it anticlimactic. No one thought that everyone was literally shocked out of their chairs. Blown away. No one expected this to be the key, I don't know if I call this a conclusion, the next step in the story. Both his opponents and his followers. Now, the opponents of Shabtai Tzvi thought that he's going to try to go to Constantinople, seize power, and he's going to be put to death. That's what they Kihilu thought were hoping for. His followers were hoping he was going to, you know, again, he was going to say, tell him these more ways to sin to him, and so he's going to hand over his power. They probably could have dealt with Shabtai Tzvi dying al Kedushashat. They could have dealt with that. And for Shabtai Tzvi to convert, that was like, no one knew the beginning. Now, the facts are the facts. It's not a fact. This is like one of these key what-ifs in Jewish history. But I don't think you can really contest this much. You know, Sabbateanism, it totally changed. It's a watershed, and Jewish history was not the same. Very deeply affected afterwards, in many ways, without a question. But the most direct issue of post-Sabbatean, you know, post 1666 Sabbateanism, the post Shabtai Tzvi's death Sabbateanism, is a, you know, it's something which takes a long time to speak about next week. Takes a long time to die out. I don't think this is like an exaggeration or a wild statement. If Shabtai Tzvi would have died al Kiddush Hashem, it would have, without, I'm scared to think of what would have happened. With him converting, it was a very difficult problem. But at least there was what's called absolute evidence that he's not Mashiach. Absolute evidence. And you're going to tell me if Mashiach dies, there's absolute evidence he's not Mashiach. Well, whatever, I don't know. That's a good question. And I don't know, who knows? It's unclear. It's very likely, however severe the problem was this way, it would have been significantly more severe if Shabtai Tzvi would have mamash died of Kedushas Hashem. I don't think anyone can argue that. Okay. Fine. Reaction to the Jewish world. Okay, so.
Wait, when did he die?
What?
Do we know when he died?
Yeah, 1680.
So, like, a while.
Yeah, he's around for 14 years after this. He died, they hid his death. They hid his death. Because they always said he was coming back, they always said he's, you know, it's temporary, he's coming back, and he was in us, but
a little bit. Know where he's buried?
Approximately. Can I give you one guess?
It's fine.
No. Everyone? Give me three guesses.
Aza?
No.
Constantinople?
No.
Was it where he was born?
Smyrna, no.
That's Smyrna?
No. Albania.
Was he born?
What? But what's Albania known for?
It's graves.
What?
It's graves.
No. What is Albania known for? Okay, just wait a second. We'll pause this for a moment.
No, no.
reaction, again, back to reaction in the Jewish world.
There's like two levels of reaction here, guys. There's mass reaction and rabbinic reaction. That's one way. That's one division. And the other one is immediate. First round of reaction, the very immediate reaction, a little after that, and then significantly after that. And then there's the long-term reaction. Those are like, it's shalosh shem, shtayim shem shalosh, or shalosh shem shtayim, depending on any one of the things. Again, everyone initially is shocked. No one knows what to make that out. No one knows what to make
The initial reaction amongst most people, and as mentioned earlier, there is a significant reason to believe that most people believe in Shabtai Tzvi.
There's a significant reason to believe that?
Most people?
Most people.
Does that include Rabbanim?
Okay, we'll get to Rabbanim in a minute. But the masses, most people believe in Shabtai Tzvi. Most people were first in a state of denial, it's not really true. And only after the United States today, if something happened, you can prove it happened. But, 300 years ago, it took time to prove things happened. There were four examples. When Reb Chaim Soloveitchik died, his son, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, or his Rebbe Soloveitchik's father, heard about it and didn't believe. And only after he got actual confirmation from the family member did he believe.
Yeah.
He didn't say he didn't do anything, he didn't believe it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it wasn't that old. Like, the records, it's not, whatever. You know, people could die at any time in their age, whatever. Well, he wasn't that young, but he wasn't that old. He was just 62, 63. It's not that old.
62?
Yeah.
Pretty young.
I mean,
I watched it back then, but
now
it's considered young.
Today, that'd be considered young, but then it wasn't considered that young, it was not considered that old. Anyway, the kids are, it's you know, you hear news and you don't know what to make out of it. So it's initially people did that camping. Then after that they went on to that note. Shabtai Tzvi is in Shemayim. He's up in the heavens. The Turks say he's apostated. It's a shadow. It's an image of Shabtai Tzvi, which looks like it's apostate, but it really hasn't. It really hasn't. Chas v'shalom hasn't apostate. That was a very commonly held belief for at least 6 months after. In other words, Shabtai Tzvi apostated mid-September. The news starts hitting places October, November. For the next 6 months, that's a very commonly believed opinion. Shabtai Tzvi is not really, apostated. He's, turned into absolute spirituality. And it's just a shadow here. It's not a real Shabtai Tzvi. Similar permutation, expression, the same thing. The opponents of Shabtai Tzvi in this initial, November, December, October, November, as the news hits, they still weren't able to, to express their anti-Shabtai Tzvi opinions. Well, they wanted to, but the masses of the majority said, no, don't, Shabtai Tzvi, you can't deny it. You speak of it, smell, or shear, Shabtai Tzvi. Crazy.
Yeah.
It's a Shiloh Kfira.
Okay. Rabbinic reaction. Okay. Now, it's important. This is like a theme which an academic, Kesher Shalom doesn't know how to really deal with properly. The problem's like this. I mean, this is true for the masses also, but for the learned core, it's even more true. Melech Mashiach is one of the main
foundations of the Buddhist Israel is there. You know, the Rambam listens to it. I mean, it's an interesting question. Next year, Be'ez Hashem, we'll be speaking about that. Why does the Rambam think that the belief in the Melchim Shiloh is one of the Yudhim? It's a good question. It's not so clear. I'm not. Whatever. Hopefully, next year, I'll have something else to say about it. But nice, whatever you say about it, you have to understand it is a very clear statement, very clear and important part of the Jewish religion. So, you know, it's not, it's a cutting thing. In other words, if Lu Yitzur, you try to bring proof against Maimon Har Sinai, so we're not going to believe your proof. I mean, there's another, I want to diverge off a moment. And the diversion's like this. At the core, at its core, is Emunah, is Jewish belief, logical or illogical? If you want the air conditioning, you have to be turned off. That's the question. At its core, is Jewish belief logical or illogical? You see what I'm asking, Sam?
You mean by logical?
What do I mean by logical? This is something that, even if you can't absolutely prove, there's a lot of proof that it's working with law and form of logic, or no, it's what's called leap of faith. E.g., if you look up the word belief in a dictionary, the word belief in the English language, in Western culture, means a principle strongly felt and strongly thought and felt, even though there's no way to prove it. What is at its core Emunah? Is Emunah in a Jewish sense a logical? It's a basic continuum of logic, or it is no? We don't have real proof. We don't really. We can't really say we know, but we believe anyway, even though we don't know.
I would say it's a little bit of both.
What?
Depends on who you ask.
Yes, I get it. So who do you think says what?
I think it's logic.
Sam says it's logical. Sam's a good look fuck. So he says it's logic. And you're probably going to tell me that Hasidim say it's not logic. You're not going to say that? Okay, whatever.
Bam.
Anyway.
Bam.
Okay. I just, you know, like, parenthetically, this is not the main topic here, but, you know, I know that the world convinces you, especially when you're younger, that everything today in all disciplines of study is absolute, and they know everything about everything, and blah blah blah, and present the theory as absolute fact. I'm not going to like upset the apple cart, as it could be said, but once you get outside of mathematics and physics and observed real physics, I'm not talking about astrophysics, which the observations aren't so clear. It's quite debatable what really should be called and what shouldn't be called science. What has real substance and what doesn't? What is merely a lot of, you know, just strongly felt ideas without absolute proof? You know, as my mother says, you know what they say doctors are practicing medicine?
They
figure it out as they go on. Yeah, I didn't tell you guys the story of my mother and hepatitis. Did I tell you guys the story? Okay, the story is like this. My mother was exposed to hepatitis here.
Oh, yeah.
You know the story? Okay. My mother was exposed to hepatitis. My hepatitis, as I recall, has it's 18 to 21 day incubation period.
Incubation.
That means if you're exposed now, you're going to get sick in around 3 weeks.
Oh, okay.
You're going to get sick between 2.5 to 3 weeks.
Right.
But she collapsed 5 weeks after she was exposed to hepatitis, taken to the hospital. Okay, my father shows up. My father says, test her for hepatitis. Doctor, when was she exposed to hepatitis? He says, gives a date. Doctor says, that's 5 weeks ago. Not possible. 18 to 21 day incubation period. My father, she was exposed to hepatitis.
why don't we test her for hepatitis? Doctor, 18 to 21 day incubation period. We're not doing Kyle, you're running a blood test, right? Yeah. Why don't you check for hepatitis? Okay. I'm a rocket scientist. And as far as I'm concerned, up to 1 in 100,000 is something you have to worry about. Can you do me a personal favor and check her for hepatitis? So, he checked her for hepatitis. And she had hepatitis. Right? Duh. She should have taken a rocket scientist for it. But that's what they say. Doctors are practicing medicine. You know, everything, you know, even though they present things at a lower level as obvious, clear, etc., on a higher level, it's certainly not. Anyway, yeah, Nazi Lenyane. So now we're getting all the way back to Amuna. Is Amuna logical or illogical? If you believe that Amuna is, quote, leap of faith, and there's probably machlokes about it, but definitely there, I don't want to get into the nitty gritty details. We'll probably talk about that more next year also. But if you think that Amuna means leap of faith, which I agree with Sam, I don't think it does. But if you think that, then you certainly don't have a kasha. There's proof. There are people who say it. It's not. There are people who say it. Then certainly, you understand that it's not going to be aleph bays when you do it in such a case. Mikal Malkam, the majority of rabbinic people, after Shabbat Tzvi converted, said, well, he's certainly not a Yeshiva, but he's not a Yeshiva. Now, you think that's obvious, but there's going to be a minority, which we'll talk about next week, Bezer Hashem, which doesn't think that. And here, why do you think the minority doesn't think that? Who should we blame for that? There you go. It all goes back to the of Gaza, doesn't it? Okay, fine. Bye, Jim. Okay. So. Okay. Fine. So now, the second round of it is that after the news keeps coming back, you can no longer say that Shabtai Tzvi is not physically there, he's definitely around, he was living in Adrianople for an extended period of time, plenty of people have seen him, Jewish people, sit down reports, and you can't tell me that he ascended up to Shemesh Shemayim into Rebbe Shalom, and his shadow's here pretending to be Muslim. You can't say that anymore. So that gets us to the second round of reaction, and that's where things really start. So there's the first round, like, well, the second round is where things really start. Of the people who used to believe in it, some of them become extremely bitter because of their mistake, and they turn radical anti-Shabtai Tzvi people. And they join forces with the original Kofrim / anti-Shabtai Tzvi sources. And these two groups of people join together and now disseminating a extreme anti-Sabbatean, you know, doctrine all over the place. Yeah, what's his name? The France, the most well-known, of course, is Jacques Sportus. There's also the Francis brothers. They write parodies and you know, and et cetera, all about how terrible Shabbat Tzvi was. They like have a mock. They write a mock anti-Shabbat Tzvi Pesach Seder. 10 plagues of Shabbat Tzvi brought on the Jewish people, etc., etc. Okay, so that is a minority of the, you know, people who initially believe join forces with the people who never believed. Now, one of the insults that the pro-Shabbat Tzvi people had said beforehand was, anyone who doesn't believe in Shabbat Tzvi is preventing the Gula from coming, and it's from the Erevrav. And a well-known pro-Sabbatean Rav, Rabbi, had written that right before Mamash, not more than a week before Shabbat Tzvi apostated. And as you can imagine, the anti-crowd, especially the original anti-crowd,
It's, you know, like, you know, major ammunition. Because, of course, the turntables are very trained now. And there's no question that statement was extremely wrong and off.
Okay. Right. So what's done? Now this is very fascinating. This is a very important historical pattern. How do the majority of Rabbanim and leaders, the community leaders, deal with Shaftei Tzvi? The majority of Rabbanim and community leaders deal with the Shaftei Tzvi issue by ignoring it. By going back to normal, don't mention Shaftei Tzvi, don't talk about it, pretend it didn't happen. Does that sound familiar? That is the favorite way we have of dealing with problems. Sort of like a friend of mine says that his brother-in-law spoke to a certain person who some people think is a gullah. Obviously I'm recording this. I'm not sure if I should record this, but I got this far and I'm recording. And he was telling him about this person deals in chinuch and education. He was trying to talk about certain problems. And this call, this was not in public, understand? If this was done in public, I wouldn't be as critical. This was done privately. He says, we don't take care of problems, we sweep them under the carpet. So, this is key to, I want to call this a tadat and sayaya, but there is down here feeling, and this is something that we see here, and it's a good question if there's any earlier sources for this. There is definitely, there's no question, the Torah is a big power. You know, Torah is a great Torah, and Yiddishkeit are major powers. And there's a lot of inertia in Torah, and you go with Torah. And obviously, the reason why, even if it's not completely successful in solving the problems, the reason why this pattern and this concept of pretend the problem doesn't exist, pretend everything's normal, the reason why that works largely is because when you go with it, the power of inertia that the Torah and classic Torah, classic orthodoxy has, usually is strong enough to roll over the bump and keep on moving. And we're going to go on the stage and see. It's a hard question. I mean, of course, we like to think everything we saw. That's just choosing to go with David about the different, permutations of this type of problem today. We like to think we can solve every problem. Because that's part of being living in the scientific era. And we can't. There's a lot of problems we can't solve. And it's easy for me to say that, you should have dealt with the problem, but there was no absolute authority to deal with it. I mean, it's been a long time since that level of authority existed in the Jewish nation, even today, in the rosiest of pictures that could exist here in Israel. There's no way in the world we could deal with the problems by force. We're living in a democratic, open world. It's not going to work. Okay, whatever. Anyway, so what they did was, though, they did have something called a cherem. And with a cherem they used initially was not against followers of Shaftei Tzvi. That's going to cut in the middle. Initially, the cherem says, whoever discusses Shaftei Tzvi in any shape or form in public, put him in the cherem. That forces normalcy and pretending the problem doesn't exist. What really happened in a historical sense, though, is that drove the problem underground. As opposed to being a public open debate, it drove the problem underground and causes. And I mean, I can't. No one can say it wasn't attempted. The other way wasn't attempted. We're only another minute or two. But whatever, you can put it right back on. It drove the problem underground. And here, just wait a second. Anyway, I think that there's no question the reason why the Shaftei Tzvi episode lasts as long as it lasts was because it was driven underground. I mean, again, that's something that I'll never be able to prove. You can hit that with your hand.
No, I was going to ask
Yeah, anyway. Okay, I guess we can call it here. Okay, fine. Okay. We're going to get back to Nussan, to Nathan, and finish off longer term reverberations of Shabtai Tzvi next week, Bezer Hashem.